What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
What does every grocery store aisle now have in common? Products that come in paper packaging. And we don't just mean the obvious ones like cereal boxes and juice cartons. From beauty products to boxed water, there are more opportunities to go papertarian than ever before. So why should you? Because paper comes from a renewable resource and can be recycled up to 7 times. Simply put, it's the smart choice for the environment. And it turns out, the easiest choice for you. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Welcome, y'all, back to another episode of Her with Amina Brown. And those of you that have been listening to the podcast for a while, you know that I always talk about how when we are gathered here listening to the podcast, we are in our Her living room. But in my house, my living room is actually an open room that opens into the kitchen. And with today's guest, I feel like we are in our Her living room, and we are also adjacent to the kitchen. So I'm so excited to have all of the conversation. Palestinian author and writer whose work has won awards from James Beard, NPR, and the Guild of Food Writers. I want you to welcome author of The Palestinian Table and her latest book, The Arabesque Table, Reem Khasis.
Thank you, Amina.
Oh my gosh, Reem. First of all, let me tell y'all that are listening here that Reem and I have a mutual friend who has regaled me with your amazingness for a long time, Reem, actually. Like, our friend Lyric, shout out to Lyric. She is a fantastic culture and food journalist, photographer, writer. She's amazing. And she and I also just love to talk food.
She and I love to eat food.
Okay. So. It's like a bonding in our friendship that we're just always discussing what we're eating. And so she had told me about you and your work a while ago. And then when she reached out, like, hey, so Reem's book is coming out. And as soon as she started talking, I was like, yes, whatever you're about to say, yes. Do I want to interview Reem? Yes.
She knows the most amazing people. And she told me about you as well. She's been talking about you for a while. And she's like, I have this friend. Do you want to be on her podcast? And I was like, absolutely. I mean, I don't even need to know anything else. If you recommend her, it's 100%. So I guess we were both on the same page there.
Completely meant to be. And I'm just, y'all, first of all, I have to tell you, you know, podcasting is, it's a limited situation because, you know, there's no way for Reem and I to talk and show you how beautiful Reem's books are. I mean, gorgeous. Okay. Like, it is a wonderful combination of this writing and The recipes are there and the images are just gorgeous. So even having looked at the images, I'm like, I really wish that it was not a pandemic, that I could be like in the kitchen with you, Reem. I also want to just speak out here into the listeners that I know there are executives who work in television listening to this podcast, and you need to go ahead and make a TV show of Reem Cassis. So I'm just talking out here, and I need you to do it, and mainly selfishly so that I can be a guest.
So I can finally cook for you in person.
Okay. I'm going to be there messing up everything, eating all of it. I want to talk about some of the themes in your work. And I just really identified with a lot of those themes. And I want to talk also about your latest book, because I want people to get a chance to hear a bit about the inspiration behind it. I really identify with the fact that you wrote your first book and then you were like, that might be it.
Yeah, pretty much.
You were like, I don't know if this is coming back. So I want to start with that. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what was your journey into book writing? Did you see yourself ever getting into that? Were you, you know, I'm using the air quotes here, dragged, kicking and screaming? Were there other people in your life that were like, Reem, we would love for you to write more, share these stories more? I mean, how did that become a part of the food journey, the writing?
So it's interesting because for those who don't know me, my background was not in writing or in food at all. I did grow up in a literary family, if you will. So my grandfather was a children's author, and he was very well recognized back home. So those always felt like big shoes to fill. You know, I loved reading, I loved writing, but it was not something I thought I would pursue professionally. And then I went to undergrad in the US. I got my MBA. I worked in consulting. And it wasn't until my first daughter was born and I was on maternity leave for a year, because London's amazing like that, and that's where we were living at the time, that I started working on this book. And it actually didn't start out as a book. It started out as my desire to put together my family's recipes and stories in a medium that she could have with her wherever she went in the world. And I think when I saw them all come together, I realized, okay, these are my family's recipes, their stories, but taken together as a whole, they could be the story of any Palestinian family. And it's a story that is most often not heard and very different to the one we're used to. And I felt a sense of responsibility to share that with the world. And that's how that first book came to be, in a very simplistic way. Obviously, the journey was a lot messier than it sounds in hindsight, but that's why I always said I thought it would be my first and last book, because it wasn't something that I jumped into with the idea that I'm going to turn this into a career. And then once the book came out, obviously I did interviews and podcasts, and people would ask questions like, what is the difference between Palestinian cuisine and Lebanese or Syrian? And I started digging into this whole idea of food history. And I was shocked at what I realized, which is that the lens through which we look at cuisine is very distorted, because it only looks back in the range of 100 to 200 years. But cuisine is so much older than that. The very idea of national cuisine is a relatively recent construct. So with this new book, I wanted to grasp in a way, or showcase, what a modern Arab table looks like. What do we eat at home today as Palestinians who live abroad, who have access to certain ingredients but not others, who have friends from one part of the world and another? And at the same time, I realized, if I want to show that with integrity, I have to trace the history of these dishes. And that's kind of where the idea for this book came from, and how it evolved into the one that you see today.
Mm. Reem, you voiced just now something that really meant a lot to me in your work, that you didn't want your writing to be disconnected from history. And I just think that's so powerful. And I mean, also, I am a person that's very inspired by old things, but I think a part of it is because, to me, it feels hard to make or write or capture if I'm not also aware or bringing into the space, this is not a new thing we're doing. Even if we are here now, where there are these types of appliances or these ways our homes may be set up now, we are doing a thing that has historically been done as well. And I love that connection.
I mean, cuisine in general, Amina, it's also, it runs so deep. And if you look at its past, it is very cross-cultural. It is very integrative, right? You know, you learn from other people, your circumstances, occupations, wars, empires, they influence it. So knowing your history and cherishing it is not mutually exclusive with evolving and changing. And I guess that was the point I was trying to get across, because you see so many people who will cook a certain dish and either attribute it to one cuisine or completely forget to attribute it to a certain cuisine, as if recognizing the history detracts from the beauty of what we have today. And I think it's the opposite. Seeing how much something has changed and understanding its rich past makes us appreciate it all the more, even if that past is not always a pleasant one, which in many cases it's not.
Right, right. I think the other thing that I want to talk to you about also in the idea of how, especially when we're talking about food, and we can't talk about culture without talking about food, and then we can't talk about food without talking about culture. I mean, they're just so like interconnected that way. But when we're talking about food and culture sort of interlinked together, I think in particular, and I don't know if this is an American thing, a West thing, a colonization thing, I just don't know. But I'm going to bring it up here because I'm interested to hear your thoughts about this. Even for me, like I love to cook, but I'm like a home cook. I love to say, like, I might make ugly food, but it still tastes amazing. I'm just, you know, I don't really plate.
I don't either.
I'm just like, here is everything. It's delicious. I don't know what it looks like, but it's here.
Tastes good.
Exactly. And as I've grown as a home cook and sometimes have desire to cook things from other countries or other cultures, I've noticed how it can sometimes take a little more digging to get to the writers and chefs that are actually native to that culture or native to that country, where you're actually getting to hear from them how we make this, what is the history of this, that there are other sites, I won't name their names here, but other sites that exist there that you're like, oh, I'm going to find this particular dish. And then you get there and, you know, it's somebody wherever they live in the middle of wherever, and they're like, here's how I make this. And then when you actually read that from a writer that's writing about what they ate of this in their family of origin home, you know, or growing up in their mother, aunt's, grandmother's kitchen. And I think that is also really integral to your work and why I am so glad your voice exists, because we want to hear about this from you. We don't want to hear about it from someone who, this is not home, this is not family to them. Why do you think that's important for writers like yourself to share these stories from your own upbringing, your own cultural experience?
I think it's a couple of things. I mean, you know, for starters, you can't divorce food from culture because so much of it is dependent on the context. So many of the dishes that I will talk about, it's not just a sum of the ingredients and the way the dish tastes or looks like. It's also what it signifies. What occasions is it eaten on? What history does it tell? How did it change over time? You know, there are dishes now, which I talk about in the book, made with rice. But traditionally, my grandfather tells me, you know, they were so poor that rice was something reserved for the wealthy. They only ate bulgur grains. Mm. And someone coming from outside the culture trying to tell you a certain story about a dish, he might cover or she might cover just the way that dish is cooked today and forget all that history that brought it to the point that we're seeing. But also, other than that, I mean, what I notice sometimes is you look at a certain dish and you can bring 10 Palestinians. And each of us will tell you, oh, no, this is the way it's supposed to be made. And this is the way my mother makes it. And they're all right. There's nothing wrong with them, right? You know, I always say this, especially about ma'lube, which is considered one of the national dishes of Palestine. There are probably as many versions of it as there are families in the country, which is totally okay in my mind. And then I struggle sometimes. I think, well, what about if someone wants to convey that dish to the Western world? And that person is not Palestinian. Mm. Is that wrong or is that right? And I don't have, you know, I wish the answer was clear cut, black and white. It's wrong. It's right. I think if you're someone who has immersed yourself in that culture, if you are a non-Palestinian who has lived in the country, lived amongst its people, understood that culture, and you're doing it justice, I don't have a problem with that. You know, some people will disagree with me and they'll say, no, you have absolutely no right. But then you start drawing a line where there's no creativity and there's no interaction, and cuisine was not meant to be that way. It never was. The issue I have is when someone gives you a dish that does not recognize the origin, is not even remotely close to what the people in the country eat. And then once you bring in the issue of profit, who's benefiting from it? And I'm not just talking financially. Mm-hmm. I'm talking, you know, publicity-wise, who's getting the recognition for it. If you're getting it at the expense of the people who have provided you with this, then we start to have an issue.
Yeah. Oof, that's such a great point. And even for people that might, to use the example you gave there, for people who might be non-Palestinian that may want to share this such and such recipe, it's like if you were immersed in the culture, if you have been immersed in a culture that isn't your own, then the hope would be that you even walk into whatever that page or writing space is with this sense of honor, which, you know, to what you were talking about in your own writing process, that is still connected to history, mm-hmm. that is still connected to the culture in which the food is rooted, which I think is so powerful and so beautiful. I also want to talk about home, because that is this theme that comes up a lot in your work. And it's also a topic that fascinates me because I was a kid that moved around a lot growing up. And then I, you know, before the pandemic anyway, I was traveling mostly, became a performing artist that traveled a lot. So my sense of home is very, I mean, sometimes I look at it and think like it's fractured on some levels because, you know, it wasn't like I grew up in this home from being born until I got out of high school or something and then went into my adulthood and made that place home. It was sort of like all these different places became home to me. But I'm always interested in how we talk about home because there are so many different ways to define that sometimes that is a very specific place. Like I was actually talking with my sister the other day about how home is very specifically for me, my mother's house. Mm-hmm. And it's like wherever my mother's house is, if it's down the street, if it's
that's home,
you know, wherever she is in her house, when I step across the threshold, I am at home. Mm-hmm. When you think of home, could be one place for you, could be specific places, but what are the specific, like, concrete places you think, oh, that feels like home to me?
So it's interesting you say it's where your mom is, because for me, it's a combination of location and as well as people. Mm. You know, my mother used to always say, for me, home is where my kids are. My grandmother used to say the same thing. She would say, holidays are when my kids are together. So there's a sense of home is where the people that you love and care most for are. With that said, I notice, you know, I live outside Philadelphia now with my husband and two daughters who I care about more than anything in the world, but I constantly feel uprooted. I don't feel home. Mm. And I think in large part, and I talk to my husband about this all the time, I say like, you know, what do I have? Where are the roots? Where is the family, the history that ties me to this place? And it's not here. And if I go back to, you know, my paternal or maternal grandparents' villages, I grew up in Jerusalem, so I didn't grow up in those villages, but I go there. My grandmother, my great-grandmother, her mother, everyone is rooted to that place. Everyone knows everyone. You are born and you die in that place. And I used to look at that like, oh my God, I want to get out. I want to see the world. Like, this is so claustrophobic. And now that I've left and I've seen everything, I realize how much value there is in being in a place that can be traced so far back that gives you a sense of place and meaning. So for me, the places that really mean home are the people. It's obviously my parents, my brother, my husband, my kids. But when I'm back home in Jerusalem in particular, it's where I grew up. So in the old city, that's associated with so many pleasant memories for me that it screams home when I go there. Mm. But then also the villages that my grandparents are from, they're very different. You know, it's very rural. It's very communal. It's changed over the years. But when I'm there, I feel a sense of belonging that I don't always feel in other places. But then the flip side of that is having lived so long outside, I also feel like an outsider when I go home. Mm-hmm. And I'm constantly straddling this divide, and it's not an easy place to live in. You know, people look from the outside and think, oh, it's glamorous. You live in one place, you travel to another. But it's actually, it's almost a burden on some days.
Yeah, on a level, I'll say I get that. Not as much having the international elements of that, but having sort of grown up visiting where my parents both grew up in North Carolina, that that mm-hmm. was home for them. But because mm-hmm. my grandmother was there, it felt like home to me.
Yeah.
But we were of my mom's siblings, I think we moved around the most, my mom and my sister mm-hmm. and I. So we were sort of like always rotating around that. And there were times where we would come home and sort of be with our, you know, our, what would I guess be like second cousins. By the time you get to like your second and third cousins, we had enough family in North Carolina that that's what it was like there. And feeling like, oh, like, well, my voice sounds very different.
Right. The accent. Yes.
Right. Like from their yes. voices. And like, mm-hmm. I remember the town that my grandmother was from, and my parents both are from that same place, you know, where they would go for fun to like this particular skating rink, you know, and I was living in bigger cities with my mom by that time, where it's kind of like, oh, that's all you have is this little skating rink. Oh, but to my cousins, it's like that skating rink's everything.
Right.
Because that's where everybody of a certain age is going to have fun on a weekend. Mm-hmm. And those different aspects are so interesting to how we find home, you know, hearing you talk about that, just this like duality there of like, mm-hmm. there is something about the air there and the soil there that feels home to me.
Absolutely.
But there is this element of like, but this is not where I grew up, or I really went to school. Maybe 1 year I went to school there living with my grandmother, but otherwise, you know, I want to also ask, as we're talking about home, I want to talk about the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I'm riveted by how there is this generation of womanhood in your writing, Reem, that it is you as mother to your daughters, the things that you want them to know, mm-hmm. but it is you remembering yourself as a young girl in these kitchen moments with your mother and your grandmothers and so on. Can you talk about what's the scene like in the kitchen with the other women in your family? Is the kitchen, obviously it's the place where like, is the food getting prepared? Is the food getting cooked? It is. Are other womanhood lessons happening there in the kitchen? And what were some of those that you remember or that you experience now, even with your own children?
So the experience is very different because I like to have my girls in the kitchen and I like teaching them and talking to them. For my mother's generation and my grandmother's generation, it was get out of the kitchen.
Really?
Because they looked at, you know, my grandmother was not that way with my mother, but my mother was that way with me because she looked at my generation as the one that was going to get out of the kitchen and was going to do something. So if I tried to cook, it was leave, go study. This is not your thing. You know, when I mentioned that I was thinking to write a cookbook or do something with food, my mother's response was, who goes and gets an MBA to end up in the kitchen? Of course, she backtracks and says she never said that, or if she said it, she didn't mean it that way. And, you know, it's it's a point we talk about all the time. And I mentioned this in the book. It wasn't just her. It was everyone in society back then, someone telling my father, why send her to the US for university? She's going to end up in the kitchen anyway. Mm. So there was that element of it. But as most kids will tell you, whatever you're not supposed to do, you want to do. And so I wanted to be in the kitchen. I wanted to see what they were cooking. It's also where you heard all the gossip, right? Because that's where the women are. So that's where you learn about things you're not necessarily supposed to learn at certain ages. I remember my grandmother had this, I guess you would call it a pantry these days, but it was a room above her fridge. You had to climb on a ladder to get to it. And my cousins and I would hide in there. And of course, we'd listen in onto everything that the women were saying. And other times, you know, we'd run in and out of the kitchen. We'd try to help out, but the women would shoo us and whatnot. But once you get older, they start relying on you a bit more. And you start to learn some of the tips and tricks. Although for me, most of the learning was visual and auditory. I wasn't actually helping out in the kitchen. I think the first time I cooked, I was an undergrad and I wanted to make matluba in my dorm kitchen. I don't even know how I pulled it off, but it was long before Zoom and FaceTime. And my mother goes at one point, it's cheaper for me to get a ticket and come cook it for you than to pay your long distance phone bill. Like, stop calling to ask how to make it. So, but I learned along the way. I mean, it's something that there's this concept in Arabic called nafas, which mm-hmm. it means it's similar to breath or air, but in the context of cooking, it talks about something that a cook will impart into the food, part of their spirit, their love, their generosity. And I feel if someone has that, their food will turn out very good, even if you don't have that much experience. And obviously you hone it through time and through cooking.
Mm, I love that. I love that there was that little nook to hide in.
I miss it now that I think about it.
Because it was like when you're a little girl and the women in the family are gathering. I mean, it just feels like that's a place to be. Like they're going to be in there talking about all sorts of stuff.
That oh, yes. Everything, you know, who did what and who in the village and what the latest gossip is. And it was a simple time, but fascinating nonetheless.
Hey, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. As a nostalgic voice from your past, I'm here to remind you that amongst the stressful and chaotic existence we live in 2024, you deserve to get away. It's time for a vacation, no matter when you're hearing this. And let me tell you how you'll get there. The 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe. Want to bring the family to the mountains with the Santa Fe's available H-Track all-wheel drive? Well, it's got standard third-row seating and available dual wireless charging pads for the kids who just want to stare at their phone and not talk to you. You know what I mean. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On-demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Welcome to AutoZone. What are you working on today?
I got to change the oil in my car.
Right now, get 5 quarts of Pennzoil Platinum Full Synthetic with an STP Extended Life Oil Filter for only $36.99.
What do I do with my old oil?
We can recycle your used oil for free.
And do you have oil for my old work truck?
You can find the right high mileage oil to help it go farther right here at AutoZone.
Get in zone, AutoZone.
Restrictions apply.
Okay, Reem, you shared a little bit about this before, but can you talk about what the experience was like for you making the career shift that led to where you are now as an author? I just found that part of your story. I found it so fascinating, but I also think, you know, there are a lot of people listening that are sort of in this kind of in-between place before that shift happens. So can you talk about what was the shift where I feel like in your story, there's sort of this like before time, before this, that was like really different. And then how did you find yourself sort of finding, in a way it seemed from your story, and you can tell me if I'm describing this accurately, but it seems like you were finding your way back as you were finding your way forward. So what was that change like? Were you afraid when you felt the change coming?
Absolutely. I'm still afraid, if we're being honest. And that's one thing I want to preface my answer with, which people will look at someone who has transitioned and is quote unquote on the other side or has accomplished something, and they'll think, oh, it looks easy, or, oh, it looks great. But it's a struggle, and it still is for a lot of reasons, which I'll get into. But like I told you, I left Jerusalem wanting to prove to anyone who thought otherwise that a woman's place was not in the kitchen, that she could achieve professional success in other domains, that you could be in a male's world and do well. And I was on that track. I mean, I did my undergrad at Penn. I did my MBA at Wharton straight out of undergrad, which is very uncommon. I worked at McKinsey. So I ticked every single box. And then I think it hit me at some point soon after I started working in consulting that here I am ticking all these boxes, but they're somebody else's boxes, not mine. This isn't what makes me happy. And, you know, I was lucky enough where I was able to leave and transition to something else. But it was very scary when I first started out because there was no guarantee that it was going to work out. I was also, by the time that I decided to make this transition, I was married. And the issue of financially supporting myself on my own wasn't a big thing. And people don't talk about this.
Yeah.
But taking a risk like this, it requires either a willingness to really tighten, you know, bootstrap your life, or you're going to have to find a way to make ends meet if you're not, if you're financially dependent or not financially independent. So that was one part of it, which is something that needs to be talked about. You know, how do you allow someone who wants to pursue the creative arts to be able to make a living? And I get really angry when I think about this, that why is it that someone who's producing, let's just call it widgets or a tech app or whatnot, is able to go out there and raise insane amounts of money, but someone who's producing art, which is what I would argue makes life worth living, maybe it doesn't move the economy or boost it, but it's what gives their life meaning and purpose, why is that not valued in the same monetary terms?
Yeah.
And when I said to you, it's still difficult for me today, this is one of the issues where, you know, I look at people I went to school with who remained in those careers, who've made partner at those firms, which I could have already been at that point had I stayed. And obviously, as a food writer, you're not in that same bracket when it comes, you know, financially. And I think I judge myself based on those things because I was conditioned to do that. For 5 years, I was in an environment that equated success with money.
Mm.
And it's hard to transition to a point where you equate success with something else, with contribution. And that's what I think, you know, I think what's helped me is thinking in 50 years or in 100 years, when I'm not here, will there still be a part of me that's remembered, that's recognized? And I think when you contribute something to society in any kind of art, whether it's books, performance, art, painting, music, those are things that can last forever. You know, if you're not that the other work is not important, but there, I felt there were 100 people who could do the job I was doing professionally, but not that many people who could be the same mother to my kids and also produce for my people and my community the thing that I saw in my hands of. Sorry, that was heavy and a lot.
No, it didn't feel heavy to me, Reem, but it feels powerful and it feels very honest, because I think when we're having conversations about, you know, insert buzzwords here, about dreams, about passions, mm-hmm. about calling, about what that looks like in our vocations, it has been really important to me, and particularly on this podcast, because women of color are here sharing their mm-hmm. own stories and experiences, and I'm sharing some of mine too, that we have some honest talks mm-hmm. about what that actually looks like. You know, I worked in corporate for a while doing communications mm-hmm. for a big Fortune 500. And I was so excited, like, for the first time to be getting paid, you know, at that time, what felt like paid so well to be writing, right? Mm-hmm. And then 6 months in was like, wow, I hate this. I hate this. And then quitting and going broke. I did an episode sort of walking through people, like, you know, people see you, you know, at the book signing, right? Or,
right.
You know, they see your name on whatever the articles and different awards are. They see your name there and they're like, oh, goodness. And you're like, well, behind the scenes, what that really means.
Here's what it looks like.
Some struggles were had. Even mm-hmm. the day before said award was received, I was actually.
Yes, exactly.
Doing these things. So I think and hope that it's helpful for people to hear. It's not to say don't pursue this thing that you feel passionate about that may not have this like equation to how it's going to be, you know, air quotes, mm-hmm. how other people might define success. It's not to say don't pursue those things or look to make these shifts. It's to say there's rough and tumble along the journey, right?
There's rough and tumble in every path you decide to take. And I think it's recognizing that there is not a single career path in this world that you will take that will be smooth sailing the whole way through.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, okay, I have my name on books and I go to book signings and whatnot, but you know what I do at home? I wash dishes. And I, you know, I have to
okay.
all day long. That's what I do. I, you know, I'm cleaning up my stove when I forget a pot and it boils. Like, this is what day-to-day life looks like. It's not the glamorous book signings. And then when you're in corporate America or the corporate world anywhere, I was working 16-hour days. You know, I remember, like you were saying, thinking, oh my God, I'm getting paid so well. I can afford anything I want to buy now. But suddenly all those things I thought I wanted to buy, the designer clothes and handbags and shoes, I had no desire to even wear them. I just, my life felt so meaningless at that point that stuff could not fill whatever gap I was feeling.
Yeah.
And if there's one thing I've noticed is it's when you start doing something that thinks of someone else more than you or something that gives back, you find a sense of meaning much more than when you're pursuing things that are purely hedonistic just for your own satisfaction.
I love you brought up the word meaning. I think that's important. You know, when we're thinking about what do we want to do, you know, in the world, in our communities, I think it is about, is it meaningful? You know, and of course I get it. Not everything we do is going to be meaningful. Even in my, you know, current like writer event life. I mean, I'm sure for all of us that are in sort of creative space, I mean, there are all sorts of like gigs and different things that like, you know, you take something so they can pay the bills. You do that. But I think it's good for us to think about what are the things in my life, whether it's my vocation or not, that I want to do because it's meaningful, because it means something to me, or because I think it would mean something to my people or to my community. You know, I think that's so important. Reem, let's talk about the arabesque table, okay? What was the writing process like for the arabesque table? And I'm just going to tell you, I've never written a cookbook or anything with recipes in it. So I don't know that part, but I have written two books and it's a wild time for me. It's like, I feel like I start out eating a lot of carbohydrates because I'm just like, oh, why stress. Did I do this to myself? Like, it's a lot of stress. There's a lot of beautiful ideas I had when I was sketching out the book. And then I get to actually writing it and it doesn't sound like that at all.
It sounds so much better in your head than when you put it on paper. I know.
Yeah. So talk to me. What was your writing process like after you've envisioned the arabesque table? What was it like when you actually had to sit down and do the writing?
So here's the funny thing. The arabesque table was not the book I initially envisioned, and I'm so glad it wasn't. A lot of the things I'm telling you about the history and how much of it I integrated in the book, and also the idea of positioning it as Arab versus Middle Eastern, that came throughout the writing process. So in a way, you know, not knowing what you're doing sometimes is a blessing.
Okay. That's encouraging, everyone. Remember, sometimes not knowing what you're doing can be a blessing. I'm going to take that home with me, Reem. Okay, yes.
Or at least I tell myself that. But the day-to-day process, look, it was a little bit harder than the first one for a couple of reasons. One was the first book was taking recipes I'd grown up with and I knew and just testing them, making sure they worked and getting exact ingredients for them. Here, it was developing a lot of recipes, guessing what might or might not work, and sometimes having to test it multiple times, all while cooking with kids who are 4 and 6. You know, with the first book, they were a newborn and 2 years old, they ate whatever I told them to eat, or they had milk and they were fine. Whereas now it was constant complaints. And on top of recipe testing, you're cooking things that the kids will eat. But that was most of my day. And then my nights were transcribing all those recipes. And then the actual meat I kept to the very end. So that's when all the chapter intros, the introduction, that's when it all came together. And then the introduction to the book did not happen until I was supposed to go home to Jerusalem in March for my photo shoot. And 2 days before, they issued a blanket quarantine, had to cancel our flights.
Wow.
Everything was, we didn't even know if the book could come out when it was scheduled to. And I felt so much during that time, anger, frustration, just And I was able to write the introduction through those feelings. And it's not the introduction I would have imagined at all, but somehow it came out something so much better than I could have envisioned. So another hopefully useful thing is sometimes just accept those feelings, live through them. It's something beautiful can come out of it on the other side, if you will. But the writing mostly happened, yeah, towards the tail end of it. And a lot of the writing happened when I was back home in Jerusalem. So it's interesting. The recipes were tested abroad in the US, but then the more narrative part was written back home. And being able to see it from both angles or both sides, I guess, made the book what it was. It's modern, it's contemporary, it's cross-cultural, but it's also going far back in history.
Would you say location matters to your writing process? Did it do something different to you being home in Jerusalem, writing and being there, the air, you know, the feeling of being there, and then being here in the US writing? Does that add a different something to your writing process?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to scientifically explain how the writing process works, right? There's so many elements. It's like cooking. Why is it that if I cook a dish when I'm angry, it tastes one way, and if I'm happy, it tastes another way? And if I'm doing it in this kitchen, it's like this, and in another kitchen, it's like that. And I think writing is similar. It's not that being there changes the way I write, but the thoughts I have, the emotions I experience are different. And that comes through in the writing. And yes, smelling the air probably reminds me of certain memories when I was young that might not have been triggered in my mind had I been writing it in, you know, my apartment in Philly. So in that sense, yes, absolutely, it does.
I was reading through a couple of the recipes in this book, and, you know, there's all this like funny talk on the internet right now about when you go to like a blog to read a recipe, right? You're just like, oh, scroll.
I don't want to read this.
I just want to get to the recipe. But in reading your book, both are, I mean, in many blogs, they're also equally important. Okay. But in your book, they are equally important. I mean, you had one of the recipes that I was reading through was for a certain type of salad. And in your intro, you were writing about, you know, where does the idea for salad come from? What are the actual roots of in ancient food? And, you know, you were giving us that context. And then you were like, here's why I'm doing what I'm doing with this recipe now, you know, for these sort of modern context. Can you talk about, you've told us already how it's important to connect history, you know, to like what you're writing. Can you talk about the process of these recipes and the stories and history that's going along there? What was that like? And what do you hope readers gain from getting to have those layers in this book?
So I think the book has about 130 or 125 recipes in it. I started out with over 200. So the process involved a lot of elimination, and people always ask, how did you figure out which recipes you were going to keep in? And I think the headnotes you alluded to were part of the reason certain recipes stayed and certain recipes went. You have 250 pages, Amina. There's a limit to how much history you can convey. So I guess what I picked and chose were the stories that charted that journey from past to present. So, you know, rather than having five recipes whose headnotes talk about the origins of salad, I will pick one which explains how it's from Roman times and salad is the Latin word for salt and that's how vegetables are seasoned and so on and so forth. So I think a lot of it was trying to figure out, how do I tell this story? Which snippets of information can showcase the specific points I wanted to get across? And those points were a lot of the origins that we think are like that certain foods we think belong to are actually completely inaccurate. You know, things like tomatoes, people think Italian food, they think pasta with tomato sauce, or even Arabic cuisine, they think tomato stews. Tomatoes didn't make their way to our part of the world till the 19th century.
Wow.
And they're a result of the Columbian exchange or Inquisition or, you know, into the Americas. Same with other ingredients, you know, chilies, they are not native to India or to Thailand. Cocoa is not native to Switzerland or Belgium. And it's fascinating to see the history of ingredients and crops. And that's why the book is broken up by ingredients, because those are the ones that really show you the shift in the history of cuisine.
Why call the book The Arabesque Table? I want to ask on both words here on arabesque and table. Mm. Why are both of these words important to the journey of this book?
So I think arabesque is the most important word in that title. The table was similar to the first book. It was this idea that this is where you serve a meal. Everyone's welcome at the table. It was the same publisher, so it was a nice way to maintain the consistency. But arabesque was very, very important, and I fought hard to get that title on the book because I wanted it to come across that this was not just another quote-unquote Middle Eastern cookbook. Mm-hmm. And I also had an issue with the term Middle East because Middle East is a European, a Western imperialistic view of our part of the world in relation to the easternmost colony of the British Empire, which was India. So India's to the far east, Europe is Europe, and we're in the middle between the two. So it became the Middle East, but it doesn't mean anything. And a lot of terms in the social sciences don't mean something concrete, but people use them. And in the culinary world, people use Middle East because it's sensually evocative and it, you know, alludes to certain things and certain dishes in your mind. But accurately, what combines and unites the food of our region is their acculturation under Arab culture and Islamic rule. So I very much wanted the book to be Arab cuisine, and I wanted that to come in the title. With that said, it would to call it the Arab table would also not be accurate. And here I am preaching about, you know, telling the truth and acknowledging the history. A lot of the recipes in this book are the result of cross-cultural interaction. They take inspiration from other cultures, from travels. They're a modern way of eating, and arabesque alludes to the fact that it's Arab, but it's not 100% Arab. And then there's one other reason which I don't talk about in the book because, again, limited word space, but arabesque is a dance move in ballet where you have one foot on the ground with a hand reaching forward and your other leg up in the air. And I felt to me this was kind of a symbol of how you're rooted and you're grounded in history, but you're still reaching towards the future, trying to, you know, move forward, but it doesn't have to be either or. You can do both at the same time.
Ooh, that dance imagery at the end right there. I mean, the whole thing that you shared there, I hope everyone listening is really hearing Reem and learning on this, because when we are here, for those of you that are listening that are in the West, you're in the States or in other parts of the West, there is so much of how we are being told to view other cultures, other nations, other parts of the world that are not actually accurate to what it means to be there, to be from there. And so I love that correction of being able to say, let's not say Middle Eastern, let's say arabesque. I also just love how the E-S-Q-U-E, I mean, you know,
sounds so sophisticated, if you will.
it does a thing at
very
the end.
Like, I don't know how to, it sounds like the banquets that they used to have in the past, and they really were very elaborate.
Oh, I love that. Reem, what would you say, people who are listening, they are needing to get this book. I'm just know that the outro is coming and I'm going to be in the book like, everybody better take all their money. You know, I'm going to be in there just like really giving everyone the information. But what do you hope that readers receive from the Arabesque Table as they, I mean, I would think a book like the Arabesque Table, some people will read it cover to cover. Some people might read through those, you know, beginning portions where you're kind of setting the scene here, and then they'll be going in and out, looking through the different recipes, deciding what they want to cook, right? Everyone will have different ways that they approach reading the book, but what do you hope people are getting from it as they're engaging with it?
You know how we talked about the concept of home before on the show, and I wrote about this in the Palestinian Table as well. I think what unites Arab cultures across the board is the sense of home and the sense of generosity, where if somebody knocks on your door a minute before you set the table, you will always have an extra plate and enough to feed them. And I cannot obviously invite every single reader into my home, but what I hope that they get while reading through this book is the sense of generosity, the sense of welcomeness, that you are welcome into this cuisine. You are welcome not only to enjoy it, but to try it and to experiment yourself with it. Adapt it to suit your taste. You're not committing a crime by doing that. You know, it's better to enjoy it and learn about its history and then adapt it to yours so that you can continue. to eat from it. And then the other thing that less on the emotional side, I hope they realize just how many misconceptions we have about food and its origins and how important these conversations are to be having. And that we need to look at food through a much longer and deeper lens than the one that we've been looking at it thus far.
Reem, thank you so much for being a guest in our her living room, but I feel like we ventured into the her kitchen a little bit. And so I just want you to know, Reem, I am dreaming up a time when the pandemic is over that someone would just, first of all, pay you lots of money to do this on TV. And then secondly, I'm dreaming that they would pay me at least a medium to large amount to be on TV with you for one of those episodes.
I would just be happy if you can come to my house and eat at my table. So that would be good enough for me.
Yes, we're going to do that, Reem. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Amina.
This has been awesome. I'm so glad we got to gather in the living room and around the table with Reem Cassis. Make sure you get her latest book, The Arabesque Table, at your favorite bookseller. You can also follow Reem on Instagram at Reem Cassis. That's at REEMKASSIS. For this week's edition of Give Her a Crown, I want to shout out Chef Edna Lewis. I found my way to Edna Lewis when I was in the process of healing a body broken by major surgery and weeks of recovery. A friend came to my house and made me biscuits from Edna Lewis's recipe. Shout out to my friend Andy. And they were so much better than the hockey puck of a biscuit I tried to make myself. I started reading Edna Lewis's The Taste of Country Cooking. I was transported to Freetown, Virginia, to the farm and the hearth kitchens of Black women who cooked and planted and reaped and sowed according to the season. Over the years, I have cooked my way through Edna Lewis's book. It has returned me to my Southern roots. She reminds me of the women I come from. Chef Edna Lewis is one of the foremothers of Southern food and soul food. Chef Edna passed away in 2006, but her recipes and her storytelling will be passed on for years to come. Chef Edna Lewis, give her a crown. Her with Amina Brown is produced by Matt Owen for Soul Graffiti Productions as a part of the Seneca Women Podcast Network in partnership with iHeartRadio. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast.
Let's hit it. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a wave.
Surfing!
Give me a city tour.
The trolley!
Give me animals.
The zoo!
Give me some sea life. Give me museums.
Balboa Park!
Give me a woo!
Roller coaster!
What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your family vacation at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Tired of restless nights? At Leesa, we know good sleep is essential for mental, physical, and emotional health. From memory foam mattresses to hybrids that keep you cool all night long, Leesa's mattresses offer exceptional comfort and support with free delivery and 100 nights to try out your mattress in the comfort of your home. For a limited time, save up to $700 off select mattresses plus two free pillows. Go to leesa.com/iHeart for an additional $50 off mattresses and select goods. Exclusions apply. See leesa.com for more details.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah! And some waves, so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that!
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in!
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Tanner girl, go shopping.
Yeah, baby!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.